Well, I think this is another area we've been making a fair amount of progress on in the last few years. But bare gallbladders have been used in traditional Chinese medicine to treat liver diseases in particular, a number of other ailments, but principally liver complaints. And the Asiatic bears, which are the most valued, are now all endangered, and they're losing their habitat at the same time as being poached. And give you some idea, for example, Korea, which is one of the biggest markets for bear gallbladder, they think there may be only 5 or 10 bears left in the whole of Korea. So they've switched from using just traditionally the Asian bears to also now North American bears as well, to some extent.
Are these really effective remedies for human illnesses, or is this just folklore?
Well, there's a lot of truth behind a lot of Chinese medicine. The bear gall, they've actually detected a unique element in it. Western science has detected a unique element called UDCA, urso deoxychloric acid. I think I've got that right, which actually is used now as synthesized. Used in Western medicine, so there's definitely some sage wisdom there. But of course, there is no wisdom in exploiting species to extinction. There's no rationality in that at all. And they can now synthesize this active element of bear gallbladder, and they can also utilize the gallbladders of cows and pigs and domesticated animals for some of the uses as well. And there's also a whole list of alternative traditional medicines, herbal medicines, which can be used. Traditional medicine is all about making do with what's available, and what's changed is that some of these things, which were perhaps only available to very rich people with bear gall or rhino horn or tiger bone, have become available to a lot more people, and that's caused huge pressure on the species populations. So it shouldn't be dismissed at all, but they should just point to, I think, to the alternatives that exist there. And that, I think, is the most positive way to move forward. But you certainly can't throw it out completely in terms of... It's based on some sound wisdom.
So you do think that the demand for these medicinal products made with animal parts has increased over the past few years, and why do you think it's increased?
I think we might be on the decline now, but I think there was definitely a blip in the 80s, let's say, the 70s, and I put it down largely to the increase in affluence in Asia and a growing internationalism. I mean, you got to the stage where we had dealers saying they could FedEx bagels from Hong Kong to us and things like that, and obviously that sort of mobility of these animal parts greatly helps the trade. Also, the rising incomes, I think, was pretty significant, and you can see with the real declines in the rhino populations and the tigers of the late 70s, the 80s, and the ivory trade as well. At the same time, the ivory trade really took off in the 70s and 80s and then decimated elephant populations in Africa. And I think that's got to be attributed partly to affluence as well as to trade channels become open. But we have had, I am optimistic, and I do think since 1993 we've had quite a major international campaign, new laws in Asia, better enforcement, a lot more awareness through the public, and I think my personal opinion from working a lot in Asia is that a lot of the endangered species consumption was based on ignorance. People really didn't think that they were causing a problem, whether it was because they didn't realize there were so few animals, or whether because they thought, well, the animal's dead, so what trouble am I doing? And they didn't link buying with the actual killing of the animals, and that's what we tried to do with the ACAP campaign.
What effect has the collapse of the Asian financial markets had on the demand for animal parts?
Well, that's a good question, and one that I don't think anybody knows the answer to yet. And a lot of the information we get on the trade is delayed, if you like, and it's also usually anecdotal, because this is an illegal trade. You can't really go out and find out exactly what's going on. But I think it will have some effect, and it will reduce things. And I hope it'll just add to the... what I think has been the positive effects of the tighter laws in Asia, the better enforcement, and the better public awareness. I hope these will all work together. And I also think that the younger generation in Asia doesn't really have time for this sort of thing and thinks it's quite irresponsible of people to use these products. So I think and I hope that we've seen the worst of it, and that we are now on our way back up off the curve, if you like, and we can, through things like the Siberian tiger project with anti-poaching, we can start to rebuild some of those populations.
Well, in China, for instance, I understand that they've run out of wild bears to poach, and they're now factory farming bears for their gallbladders, much the same way that we raise veal calves here. Can you describe what a factory farm for bears looks like in China?
Well, just to go back there a stage, and again, this I think perhaps exhibits sort of cultural difference here, that the reason the Chinese government got into farming bears was because they wanted to protect the wild populations. I mean, it's ironic because in the end they ended up taking out so many bears from the wild to stop these farms that they, I believe anyway, they actually harmed the wild population. But the idea was to try and satisfy the demand, if you like, from farmed bile. So again, some of the intentions perhaps were right, and of the practice was unfortunate. The actual conditions in the bear farms, I think it's good you mentioned the veal there, because I was one of the first Westerners to go and film inside a bear farm. It was pretty difficult to get in and film, but we did, and it's pretty appalling. But and a lot of people have seen that film and said, God, this is disgusting and it's terrible. And I say, well, have you ever seen an abattoir? Have you ever seen a veal crating? Have you ever seen the way that pigs are kept in the United States, in the UK, where I come from? So I think it's wrong for people to get on the high horse about some of these things. Two wrongs don't make a right, having said that, and the conditions for bears are certainly appalling. They're kept in cages which are, I'd say, 4 feet by 2 feet by 2 feet, and they may be kept in that sort of size cage for their entire life. So the bear just about has room to turn around, and that's about it. We're talking heavy gauge steel cages, so there is no floor to these cages. The bear has to sort of walk on the bars. And a lot of them have serious deformities and things as a result of this confinement. Then to add to their misery, they have a small catheter, a steel catheter, inserted into the side, into the gallbladder, through which they're milked. And these are very often infected. They're often being put in very unsanitary conditions by people who are unqualified and not veterinary staff. The bears can be kept there for 10 or 15 years, which is usually as long as they last. They might live to 30 years in the wild, but in these sort of conditions they'll live for 10 or 15 years. I was going to say if they're lucky, but I don't think they are lucky kept in those conditions. So certainly, I mean, the conditions are appalling, but as I say, there's no monopoly on cruelty in China.
Oh, for sure. Contrary to the Siberian tigers, the trading in bear parts goes on worldwide, and even in the United States. Is that right?
Well, the trade in everything, tigers included, goes on in the United States. There's been a number of seizures of tiger bones being brought into the United States, and a number of seizures from Chinatowns as well around the United States. So these products it is a global industry. Traditional medicine is a global industry, and this is one of the aspects of traditional medicine. Although, you know, I think, again, the practitioners of traditional medicine in the United States and in Europe are cooperating more and more with authorities to try and wipe these things out, because I think the vast majority of traders are totally against this kind of use, and they would emphasize the herbal alternatives and the fact that, I mean, traditional medicine doesn't need these things. It is an adaptable system, and there's many other things out there. So I think the industry has been working, in as much as it is an industry, because you have to remember that a lot of these traditional medicine outlets are not in any sort of association. They're not regulated, so it's very difficult to sort of get everybody in the same team, if you like. But the thing about the bear gall business, if you like, is that there are actually animals here. There are bears here. So we did a lot of work in Canada and in the US, not just from the retail end of things, but also from the poaching end of things. And for sure there are people out there poaching bears for their gallbladders. Again, I think it's something which has reduced, because there was a point where in the 70s and 80s where people thought they could make a fortune out of bear gall, and that isn't really the case, because again, it's just as the poacher in Africa will only get $50 for a rhino horn, so a poacher here in the United States will be lucky to get $30 or $40 for a gallbladder. So and then he has to have all the contacts to sell down the line. And because bear gall, what's one of the interesting things about bear gall is it's virtually impossible to identify them from cow or pig gallbladder. So you get all sorts of scams with people using the outside of a bear gall and filling it with pig bile and flavoring them with vanilla, and all sorts of scams that go on to try and cheat customers. So in one of them we've even seen with lead weights inside and things like that to put the weight up. So people tend to be fairly cautious about buying these things. And also the Fish and Wildlife Service a number of years ago, and here in California, the Fish and Game Department did a number of sting operations where they caught quite a few people, and I think word went round from that. Los Angeles last 2 years ago, I think four people went to jail who were trying to smuggle in bagel from China, and word of that went round very rapidly. And you don't need to do a huge amount of enforcement for people to think, well, this isn't worth the risk. So again, a combination of enforcement, education and awareness, that I think can wipe this problem out.
Well, for our urban audience here, what is the difference between animals that are legally hunted and illegally poached, and how can anybody tell the difference?
Well, this is one of the problems, is that you can't tell the difference in a lot of cases after the animal is, unless you catch somebody in the act. I mean, in terms of, there are some species which are totally protected and cannot be hunted, and that's pretty straightforward and pretty easy to identify what's going on. But there are also species which can be hunted only within seasons, and there are bag limits, you can only take one animal or two animals, etc. And that, unless you catch the person sort of in the illegal act, it's pretty difficult to prove what's going on. So it's pretty difficult. But I mean, anything like the rhino or tiger bone, if we're just in the process now of trying to get some legislation passed, which is called the Rhino and Tiger Labeling Act, and what that would do would make it illegal to advertise something as rhino or tiger. So whether there was any rhino or tiger in it or not is irrelevant. The actual fact of saying it is would make it illegal. Now, ironically enough, that is already the law in China and Taiwan. So as a result of all the work done a few years ago, the Chinese and the Taiwanese laws are actually more advanced than the US law, which is kind of ironic, and we'd really like to get that in place because that then makes it easy to enforce. And it's very clear, there's no misunderstanding. The public, it's very easy. If it says it's rhino or tiger, it is illegal, and it's simple as that.
Well, I was wondering, what is the law in the United States? Are you allowed to kill bears and sell bear gall bladders and paws here?
Well, this is another interesting thing, because it depends which state you're in, and it depends not only which state you're in, but where the gallbladder came from. So there is a complex patchwork of laws across the U.S. Some states, like Idaho, for example, you can sell bear gallbladders. Here in California, you can't. This was also the case in Canada, and one of the successes of the work we did up in Canada was that now I believe there's only one province now which allows the sale of bear galls, whereas before there was three or four. And the laws are not consistent, they're not enforceable, and the whole thing is a mess. I mean, we were finding a large number of gallbladders from places like Ontario, where it's illegal to sell them, were being sent to Quebec, where they were getting a piece of paper saying they were legal and taken from Quebec, and then being sent back into Ontario. So thankfully now the Quebecois have now stopped that, and they've banned the sale of bear galls. But whenever you get a patchwork of laws like that, you get all sorts of manipulations by traders to get around the laws.
Well, the activity seems to be expanding in that legal hunters here are now trading in galls. And I also hear that Asians are coming to the U.S. specifically to poach animals.
Well, that's probably, you were talking about reports from a few years ago. But, I mean, in some states, yes, legal hunters of bears can legally hunt a bear and take the gallbladder, and they can sell it, Idaho, for example. But the case of Koreans, I think was, in fact, that came to the U.S. to poach bears. The reason for that, I think, was that they actually, the case I'm thinking of was they were actually hunting illegally, so they were actually poaching, although they could have actually come and legally hunted the bears and legally taken the galls. They would have to get a permit to take them back, but they could have actually done it. But that was a few years ago now. I think things have probably changed. Like, they were caught in a sting operation. The reason, partly, I think, goes back to this idea of genuine bear galls, and you don't know where it's come from. It could have come from a pig or a cow. So people quite often like to see the bear killed, so they know that the gallbladder is definitely from a bear and not a pig and a cow or something like that. So certainly in Thailand and Vietnam, where we've done some work, people actually order a live bear, which is brought down and then butchered in front of them. And last time I was there, actually, then a new development on that has been getting a bit of higher tech going on. They'd actually frozen the bear carcass and brought it down. They would then cut it open in front of the customer and extract the gallbladder.
Well, I hear, too, that bears are being tortured to death so that their medicine is more potent. Is that true?
Well, we didn't actually earlier talk about bear paws, but bear paw is considered a delicacy, was considered a delicacy in China. And there are various different, quite horrendous recipes for preparing the bear, and some of them call for the bear to be boiled alive. Some of them actually have the bear walking on hot coals, and it's believed that this enhances the flavour. So there have certainly been recorded cases of that sort of activity to improve the flavour before a bear is killed.
How can people in the United States help to stop this? I know, for instance, just in this neighborhood, there are many traditional Chinese medicine stores. How do you find out whether they are selling illegal animal parts? And do you just walk in and say, hi, I'd like some bear gall? I mean, what do you do to find out about this?
And it's certainly not that easy to find out what's going on. But I think it doesn't harm sometimes to have a conversation with people, and it shouldn't be done in an aggressive way, but just to find it. It's very interesting to find out people's attitudes and what they think. I had a Korean friend in Washington, D.C., who you know, said to me, found out about what I was doing, and then went and asked some of her friends, and she said, oh, yes, no, apparently it's really good. Nobody knew what it was good for or you know, why it was good, but people said it was really good. So I think it can be quite interesting to try and make people think about it, whether it's a traditional medicine pharmacist or something like that, and perhaps have a conversation on, well, where do you think it comes from, and, you know, do you know how many tigers are left, etc. And not to try and be too aggressive, I don't think, because it often is a lack of information, a lack of awareness. And if you can rectify that awareness in a non-confrontational way, then I think that is the most positive way to move things forward. If you're going to be confrontational, then people will just clam up and they won't divulge or discuss it with you. And then, you know, they feel defensive and that they should just carry on and you know, as I say in England, sod you. But if you can actually have a sort of a positive dialogue with people, then I think people's attitudes do change. Culture changes is one of the things which was first said when we started doing the work, was that, well, this is cultural and you'll never change people. And I think that's absolutely ludicrous. I mean, slavery was cultural in this country not too long ago, and various other different things. Culture changes, and I think the main thing which changes culture is awareness and then breaking down ignorance. So that is a way I think people can help.
Well, I'd like to talk about the Asian Awareness Conservation Program, which you've mentioned. Can you go into some detail about what it is and what its goal is?
A nice bit of mouthful. It's actually the Asian Conservation Awareness Program. So we call it ACAP because that's shorter. The Asian Conservation Awareness Program was kind of a response that we wanted to make as a result of our previous work. This was myself and my Taiwanese partner, Rebecca. We were doing some work on bears. We'd already done some work on rhino and tiger, and we were saying, well, what's it going to be next time? There's going to be something else. We're going to keep on repeating this cycle of animal after animal, and we wanted to try and, if you like, break that cycle, and rather than just expose one trade after the other, try and actually go for what we saw as the root cause, which was the demand. And so we'd also realized in the course of our investigations and things that a lot of people were not actually aware of what the reality was. They would say things like, well, I didn't kill the rhino, so what's the problem? Or, well, you know, the rhino died of old age and somebody picked up the horn. And if you tell them, well, no, in actual fact, you know, the rhino has been hunted down by somebody with an AK-47, and in fact, there are virtually, I think there are no rhinos in the world now that don't have to have a sort of 24-hour guard on them, they're actually quite shocked in a lot of cases. This was Taiwan. And also China, I think the same goes there, and Hong Kong and Korea and many places like that. So we perceive that there was a major lack of understanding of how the trade worked, and a big willingness to sort of try and put it over, put the blame on the poachers, put the blame on African countries, on the government, anybody but themselves, the consumers. And so we wanted to try and do a program to put responsibility where we felt it was due, which is with the consumers, and to try and persuade them to take on that responsibility and therefore not want to consume these products. So we approached a major advertising agency, J. Walter Thompson, which is one of the biggest advertising agencies in the world, through some colleagues in England, and pitched them the idea of putting together a campaign which we could take using television adverts, newspaper adverts, posters, radio adverts, you name it, whatever means of reaching the public, and then take it from country to country so that we didn't have to start all over from scratch each time and create all these materials, which can cost a lot to produce, obviously. So we did that, and we went out and raised some money to pay for some professional productions on a series of ads. We picked what we saw as five of the most important species, the tiger for tiger bone, the rhino for rhino horn, the bear for bear gallbladder and paws, and the marine turtles for turtle shell, which is still used, and people over here buy that as well as ornaments and things. And also elephant ivory, which was another product which is still on sale in a lot of places, and not just in Asia. I was in New York 4 weeks ago, and there was a shop stacked full of ivory. So again, it's not just Asian communities that consume this, but I think it is Asian communities that have a lot less information about this kind of thing. Now the Discovery Channel is all over Asia, which has only happened the last 2 or 3 years, and very popular, and you know, a lot more people are becoming a lot more aware of a lot of these issues. But when we first started ACAP, that wasn't out there. So we also, I mean, it was quite amazing that a lot of people had never actually seen the animals, and people would be selling rhino horn and would not know what a rhino looked like, which to us I think is probably inconceivable, but that is a scenario that you're dealing with. So we wanted to get a big high-profile campaign to try and raise that awareness, and we started in Taiwan, and we got a great response from the government. I mean, this is, even though we had been instrumental in getting sanctions on Taiwan only 2 years before, the government was very responsive and very keen to participate. So we had a big day at the Taipei Zoo, 25,000 people turned up. We had fantastic support from the International Advertisers Association that donated, I think, about $1.52 million worth of advertising space, TV adverts on 8 different channels, half-page colour newspaper print ads. All this we put together for about $120,000, which is a campaign probably worth about $2 million, and went out with that in Taiwan. We did some market analysis, and it looked like we'd reached probably about 17% of the population, which is, I'm told, is very, very good for any sort of advertising campaign. And the message we were putting over in very graphic terms, adverts which we would not be allowed to show here in the United States because they were showing things like a poached rhino, bears in the bear farms, which, you know, the media here has shied off showing. Ironically, although you can see people blast away with shotguns at each other, you can't show something terrible happening to an animal, which I find bizarre, but especially when it's being done for the reasons to try and prevent things happening. So these adverts went out in Taiwan, and we got a great response, and 100,000 leaflets across the country. So that was the first stage, and then we've taken it to a number of other Asian countries since. And a huge boost to the campaign, Jackie Chan, the kung fu comedian, martial artist, huge celebrity in Asia, a lovely guy as well, and a big animal lover. He, we just contacted his office and said, you know, we're doing this campaign to try and stop people consuming endangered species, and he said, I'd love to help. So he did a television message for us, and a press conference for us, and his message, his advert, which again uses very strong images of animals being killed, and the message which we put out is, when the buying stops, the killing can too. And it's a message directly appealing to consumers, and Jackie has put that message out. That has gone out worldwide now. It's been on TV here as well, and we hope to get it out even further. And I think Jackie is one of the best known celebrities in Asia, or right the way from Korea to India. He's known everywhere. He's known for his integrity, and I think it's incredibly important to have a spokesperson like that. It's not a Westerner telling you, it's Jackie Chan, and you know, that is the way to get the message over, and we're absolutely delighted that he's come on board.
Do you have any indications so far that his PSAs, that I understand he's recorded in Mandarin, Cantonese, and English, are having any effect on the population? Which is to say, has the demand for those animal parts dropped?
It's very, very difficult to judge that. But I think this sort of thing, it's attitudinal changes which happened over a number of years. I mean, even when we first did the ACAP ads in Taiwan, members of the public, I mean, for example, we went and copied a number of the ads at a video shop, and the guy at the video shop, he copied like 50 tapes for us and gave us the stock for the tapes as well. And I tried to pay for it, and he said, no, you're doing a great job, this is terrible what's happened to the animals, I really want to help. That wouldn't have happened 3 or 4 years ago in Taiwan. Attitudes are changing, people are concerned, they do care, and if they see the terrible things that are happening, they are shocked in Taiwan as they are here in the US or in the UK. So I think it'll be a long time before we see the sort of real effects of this. And there are other factors as well. It's so difficult to measure because anti-poaching has improved and international laws have improved. So it's very difficult to pull these things out. But I think what is important is that we are greatly raising awareness. And I think this will not just reduce the trade, but it will also make people more more prepared to, you know, write to their government to support conservation, perhaps send money for anti-poaching, whatever it is. And it's a long-term battle. It's not something which you win or can necessarily measure in figures immediately. But I think things like the Siberian tiger population increasing, hopefully we'll get some indications from some other populations as well. Although it's very, very difficult because, you know, we don't really know how many are out there to begin with, let alone after something. So hard numbers are tough. But I think a changing in attitude, a changing in awareness, that will reap the rewards in the end.
What are the future plans for the Barbara Delano Foundation and also for the Global Survival Network for other activities in animal conservation and also in human rights?
Ooh, well, that's a question and a half. the plans are pretty immense. I mean, some of the things that we're working on at the foundation. I'm just about to go to the Galapagos, where they've just created the Galapagos Islands off Ecuador, where Charles Darwin obviously did his sort of seminal work on species and evolution. They've just created a 40-kilometer marine protection zone all around the Galapagos Islands, which is desperately needed. There's all sorts of commercial fishing going on. But it's about the size of Switzerland, and at the moment they have one boat to patrol this huge marine area. So we're going to be equipping them with some extra boats and then more equipment, paying for some flights to spot boats that are illegally fishing. That's a major project we're taking on, and one I think which we hope will greatly enhance the protection of those islands. I'm just also going back to Orissa in India. We're providing a boat there for authorities and pulling together about 5 local organizations to do a big education campaign to try and stop the turtle kills. There was 13,000 dead turtles counted last year. This is marine turtles. This was one of the 4 only nesting sites of the Olive Ridley turtle in the world, mass nesting sites. And 3 or 4 years at 13,000, which is probably 20,000, we don't count them all, it'll just be wiped out. So we're trying to pull everyone together there and provide some funding so that we can get some boats out there and stop the illegal fishing. And at the same time, protect the fishery for the local fishermen as well, who don't harm the turtles. They're small nets. If they catch a turtle, they release them. So that's another project. We're looking at other tiger populations other than the Siberian tiger, some Southeast Asian populations which are under threat, again, from poaching and various other things. We're also trying desperately to shake things up in India to get some protection. One of the problems they have there with the national park system is a lot of cases the central government allocates money for protection of parks. The state government sits on the allocation for 11 months, and then the money comes through in the 12th month, and they can't spend it, so they take it back again. So there's all sorts of institutional problems which are causing problems for the protected areas there in India. So those are just a few of the things. There's many, many others too, but that gives you some flavor of what we're up to.
Great. And did you have any closing comments that you'd like to say to the audience?
I guess just that obviously you often hear from environmentalists with tales of doom and gloom, and the situation overall is pretty dire, it must be said. But one of the things which keeps me going is that individuals can make a difference, especially when we pull together in the same direction. And you as an individual can make a difference if you want to get involved, whether it's writing letters to the governments or corporations, you know, for example, the airlines, when they stopped the carriage of wild birds, it was only because they had letters from members of the public saying, we're not going to use your airline if you don't stop carrying wild birds. And, you know, we can use economics to our advantage as well as it destroying the world. We can use our economic power to try and stop some of these things that are going on.
Well, thank you very much. Peter Knights, Executive Director of the Barbara Delano Foundation. Thanks for coming on the program.
Thank you.
You've been listening to an interview with Peter Knights of the Barbara Delano Foundation and the Global Survival Network. This is Unheard Cries, produced for San Francisco Liberation Radio. I'm Jackie Dove. Thanks for listening.